Danon Nutritia Campus is an open science education platform for healthcare professionals overseen by a not-for-profit foundation. The foundation is led by an independent board of medical professionals and academics with one clear goal: to advance the field of nutrition and health from infancy to old age through growing knowledge, training and education of healthcare professionals around the world in collaboration with medical and scientific communities.
So hello and welcome to our podcast. This is the first in a three-part series where we will learn about the teenage brain, its development, and how to best support our PKU teens during this critical period of time. I'm Kirsten Arring, metabolic dietitian based in Copenhagen, Denmark, and today I'm joined by Bettina Honen and Jane Gilmore from the UK, both clinical psychologists specializing in teenage development and education. So please introduce yourself.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Kirsten. My name is Bettina Honen. My training, I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I work in the field of child mental health and also have a lot of experience working with neurodiversity and understanding the brain, different brain-based kind of disorders in childhood. And also have an academic background, a position at UCL, so it enables me to kind of translate research findings, you know, for the layperson in a way, and kind of try to help people discern what does it mean.
Thank you very much. And Jane?
And yes, thank you, Kirsten. It's really lovely to be here. Well, if you, I know most of your listeners aren't necessarily from the UK, but if you're attuned, you might be able to hear I've got a Scottish accent, so that's how you can identify me. So I'm a consultant clinical psychologist at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London, and also a course director in a child developmental master's at University College London. But one of my favourite pastimes has been co-author of the Incredible Teenage Brain, which is why we're here. So Bettina and I, with our colleague Tara Murphy, have a sort of resource package called The Incredible Conversation, which brings together ideas and ways to support young people as they go through adolescence. So that's my remit for today.
Yes, I mean, I suppose just to kind of introduce a little bit about what we hope to do in this series, really. I mean, the book, The Incredible Teenage Brain, came out of this kind of, there's been a seismic shift, really, in the scientific community's perception and understanding of teenagers. So historically, teenagers have been seen, you know, as a difficult time in life. It's something to endure as a parent and as an adult supporting teenagers. You know, this idea that the brain is broken or deficient. But actually, these new insights from neuroscience have helped us to see that there are these cognitive changes, social, emotional changes that go on. But actually, they are highly adaptive for the things that teenagers need to do and to learn. And we really believe that adults have a huge role to play in kind of shaping the teenager's life. And we talk about this in the book and a podcast, and in this podcast series, we hope to focus a little bit. So we'll be talking a bit about broad ideas within neuroscience about brain development, brain functioning, some of the important skills that teenagers need to learn. And you know, their brain is ready to learn some really important skills, particularly in the context of PKU, actually. And then some of the kind of focuses for the teenagers, so we can understand their point of view, understand their position a bit more. You know, their focus on peers and identity and risk taking. So we'll be unpicking that as we go along. And then you've provided us with some cases, which we will also try to kind of interpret, kind of think about the cases with this brain science in mind. And what does it mean as a professional and also for parents as well?
I can say from my point of view, we are a national clinic. We have close to 500 patients in Copenhagen, Denmark. We get them from newborn and we treat them lifelong. So when I see a new family coming in with a newborn, I tell the parents what to do, give them advice, and they trust us, they trust me. And then over the years, all of a sudden, this beautiful little child is a teenager. They don't want to listen to the parents anymore. The parents come back to me and say, what should I do? And I say, I don't know, because I can't talk to this child either. So how do we actually cope with this? I mean, it has changed from a little, very knowledgeable child to becoming a very stubborn, rebellious teenager. And we're all in shock. I mean, I have three children myself, so I know what I'm talking about also from the home front. So it's really a wake-up call to all of us, like everything was so good, now everything is just so bad, so chaotic, what do we do now? So understanding teenagers is not always very easy, and the research around the adolescent brain and neuroscience has expanded so much over recent years. Could you introduce us into the concept of the teenage brain? What is the first thing we as clinicians closely working with preteens and teens need to know about this period of time?
Well, Kirsten, I love the way you talk about the idea of seeing this young person from birth all the way through and things change. Yes. And that is exactly, you know, our point, I think, because until fairly recently, we were taught, you know, in the olden days that, you know, the brain stopped developing around infancy. Mm. And actually what we know, this is very different, because there is a period of time in adolescence where the brain goes through this phenomenal change again. And most importantly, I think, for us, is that that change, that period of adolescent brain development, is from about the age of puberty until 25 years old. So actually, it's much longer than you might first assume, which means that our opportunities and our capacity to offer this young person a different level of support is actually for a longer period of time. OK, so some parents do feel, somewhat concerned about that length of time, or health professionals, but actually this is a chance, this is an opportunity. Okay, so what it means is, you know, if we think about the brain during adolescence, it's very much like a sponge. I mean, the phraseology is neuroplasticity. So basically, it takes in the environment. So that's not to say that environment isn't important in middle childhood or in adulthood, but during adolescence, there is a period of time in which the brain is incredibly sensitive to the environment. Now, the environment might be the food that we eat, the environment may be the adults around us and the emotional support, but it does mean that we, as the adults around the young person, need to do things differently.
Yes.
It's an opportunity to lay down new habits, because the brain is linked to the idea of learning. So it's really ready to learn about the environment. So that means that we can allow the young person to develop new lifelong healthy habits that are positive, but it also means that they are vulnerable. And one of the key vulnerabilities, I think, as a mental health professional or a medical health professional that we should bear in mind is that if there are going to be mental health issues, they are most likely to emerge during this period of time. And so that's an important part to bear in mind, particularly if we think about the PKU diet. And if it is poorly managed, we might get poor concentration, a foggy mind, maybe a little bit lacking in focus. Now, that might well be a reflection of a poorly managed PKU diet, but it may also be a sign of a mental health issue. It may be both, it may be neither. But the point is, as professionals, we will need to hold both of these in mind. And I think that's a hard task. But I think if there's one thing that Bettina and I would like to leave this podcast is with that idea in mind, holding those two issues, the medical as well as the emotional issues.
Yeah, I mean, just to shift a little bit, the other thing that I think we cover in the book, and I think is really helpful to know about the brain, and this is actually not just the brain of teenagers, it's the brains of all of us, but I think it's very helpful, and just to understand the brain in a way of thinking about two brain states. So we kind of have more of an emotional brain, and where we make emotionally driven decisions, and we have a rational brain, we have the cortex, the thinking brain. And we can think about it as a kind of upstairs, downstairs brain, and Dan Siegel has written this about this, and so a really lovely kind of model. But what we know is that we make our best decisions when we're in our upstairs brain. This is true for all of us. When we're in our downstairs brain, you know, that's when we do the things we regret, when we lose it, you know, when we shout at our kids, when we, whatever happens when our kids shout at us, or whatever. Also when we're sad, you know, the lower brain, the emotional brain takes over. We also know that particularly with teenagers, with children, but teenagers as well, to engage the thinking brain, teenagers need to feel safe. They need to kind of be supported. Their kind of self-protection system needs to be calm. So if they're feeling anxious, then the lower brain is more likely to be in charge. So that needs to be calm. And also motivation is important. So the lower brain, if we are internally motivated to do something, obviously it's much easier to get our thinking brain in the right place. So why is it this important? Well, it's important just to remember that we will get the best decisions from young people when they are in their thinking brain. It helps us to also to understand teenagers and think about the best way of talking to them when things have gone wrong. So when there has been, an incident, when they've maybe come off their diet or something like that, you know, or when teenagers have done something wrong, what we tend to do is we go to them, we shout at them, don't we? Why did you do that? You know, what was going on? When everyone's feeling angry, when everyone's in their lower brain, there's no point in doing that in that moment. Actually, we have to wait until they're in their rational thinking brain before we have those conversations. So it's important as a professional to know that, and very much so for parents. The other thing is, I mean, what we'll come on to talk about is the context in which teenagers are making decisions. We want them to be in their thinking brain when they're making important decisions about their lives, and getting them into their thinking brain or making sure that the thinking brain is in charge is very important. I mean, the other, just related to that, we also know that the memories are very closely linked to the emotional part of the brain. And we have a way of very quickly learning about things as a kind of safety mechanism. So if we have been in a stressful situation, then our brain very quickly learns to associate that stressful situation with feeling frightened or angry or the lower brain taking over. So that's when we get very easily triggered. If we've had something very painful or difficult happen in the past, we can easily get triggered into our emotional brain. And that's also something, I suppose, for these kids who would have been through a lot, I would imagine, or they could have been, you know, medical procedures and those kinds of things. So just really always holding in mind those two parts of the brain when we're thinking about how we talk to a teenager and thinking about the behavior the teenager presents to us.
Yeah, it's a lesson to learn from oral of us, I'm sure. When we look at the PKU children, they have been used to a lot of support and control around them. Everything has to be extremely strict, the diet and blood sampling and what can you do, what can you not do. The parents, they feel more safe keeping them at home, and then friends can come over and sleep. They don't want them to go to the friend's house. What if the mother does not understand this diet? So when preteen starts to move to having more independence and eating away from home, they have maybe sleepover camps, they go to summer school with the school, then the parents start to worry and they call us. And then we, of course, plan what they should do. They should pack all the food and bring with them. They should have blood sampling equipment and stuff. And the parents will try to control as much as possible. But sometimes it goes wrong. And they are in shock. And I think the child didn't even plan not to take the blood sampling, not to avoid drinking the amino acid supplement. Why did it end up in the trash can? They didn't plan to do this, but it just happened. And they can feel very guilty afterwards. So how do we cope with this situation? Because for many years, the parents thought that we were the gods. We knew exactly what to tell them what to do, and we would always fix it for them. And all of a sudden, we cannot fix it for them anymore.
And I think that's, you know, that's a wonderfully described dilemma there, because, you know, what can we do? And you raise so many important points there in that scenario, because what you're saying is, look, that there was an enormous amount of control in younger childhood, both as a professional and as a parent. Now, as we know that this young person has changed setting, they are on a different setting and the world is different. So the strategies that we used in middle childhood will not be as effective, whether we're a parent or a professional. Okay, so we've got to change our approach. And I think that differential between control and managing is probably where the key lies. And the reason for that, and one of the best ways I think to help professionals and parents think about their strategy, is to consider what's going on in the brain, what is actually different. So there are a number of tasks the young person has to achieve in the period of adolescence in preparation for adulthood. So they need to get to understand what the future community is going to be like. And that means that they are incredibly interested in their peers. So their peers are their future community. They need to know what the rules are. They need to know how to be accepted. Ideally, they should be, you know, popular in that peer group because that is their protection for their future community life. They also need to explore the world. So that means testing out new experiences, perhaps being revolutionary in how they think and what they do. And so there's a drive towards risk-taking in some instances, sometimes positive and sometimes negative. They need to find out who they are and what they like and what they don't like. So these, as Bettina said, these drives towards learning are driven using strong emotions because that's a super efficient way of learning about the world. And they need to know who they are. You know, that's the idea of self-identity, which may be part of PKU, and it may be about phases of rejecting PKU completely or, you know, becoming very involved with the idea of PKU's identity. And that's something we'll talk about a little bit more as we go on. The final drive is a really important one, and you touched it on that. You actually used the word independence. We need to learn as an adolescent to become an independent adult. So we have to separate from our family and figure things out for ourselves. Can we survive by ourselves? And there's a real push towards doing that. So in other words, the brain is telling us in adolescence to do things differently and explore differently. And this is a brilliant piece of evolution because it means that peers, for example, become super interesting and family is less so because we want the young person to get into the peer group, figure out what's going on, figure out what, you know, what makes a good community member and so on. And so the brain is basically getting the young person in the right place at the right time to get the right experiences while their brain is like a sponge. So it's brilliant. But as an adult surrounding or supporting that young person, having that context can change the way you understand the behaviour in front of you. And that is the golden opportunity. It's like, it's almost like a recipe book. You go, aha, I can see that drive towards autonomy or that drive towards peers. I know why that is. Now, it's not changing necessarily anything except my understanding. And that's the start of a great development pattern.
Yeah, and I'm just picking up actually, Kirsten, on what you say there, about what really struck me by what you said is that everybody's a bit in shock, yeah. You know, so the young person goes out thinking, no, that's fine. And mom's told me I need to do this and I need to check it then and I need to take this powder. And then it doesn't happen. It really makes me think about the last part of the brain to develop is the front bit of the brain, and it's called the prefrontal cortex. Now, the prefrontal cortex houses something called the executive function skills. So these are the skills that allow us to make good decisions in life, to plan and to organize, to manage our time. Working memory is one of the executive functions, holding things in your mind, remembering to do them, bearing in mind the context. Now, the executive functions go on developing well into our 20s. What we know is that very early in childhood, parents are naturally, they are their kids' executive functions, right? You don't allow your kids to cross the road by themselves. You don't allow them to have to manage their diet by themselves, right? Because we know that their brain is not yet ready to do that. And yet then during this period of adolescence, the brain is taking over those skills. Those skills are developing. But there's this period of time when we need to let go a bit and allow them to begin to kind of take the reins. But I suppose one of the things, and when we were kind of doing some research for this podcast, having a look at the research, what we know is that actually executive function difficulties is common in PKU. So there is a greater chance, it's almost quite cruel, isn't it, that there is a greater chance that young people with PKU may struggle with these executive function skills, to kind of naturally develop them on their own. And what that means is that we need to help them a bit more. I think when we see an executive skill dysfunction, and an example would be, I intended to go and do that thing and I came home and I didn't do it. It didn't happen in the meantime. We might interpret that as they're lazy, they don't care, and, you know, become quite catastrophic ourselves. What's this mean? You know, is they're going to be like this for the rest of their lives? All those kind of things. Well, as adults, we need to just hold on to it. Remember, their prefrontal cortex is developing. This is a time to help them to develop that skill. You know, I've been doing it for them. Eventually, they need to be doing it for themselves. We have a period of 10 years where we can teach them. Holding on to what you would call a growth mindset. So remembering that the brain is developing and there is an opportunity for change. Just because they failed once does not mean they're going to fail forever. And actually, in one of the later podcasts, I think we're going to talk in a bit more detail about a kind of template for a way of teaching executive function skills in quite a detailed, structured way, which I think is just going to be so, so valuable for this population of young people.
I had so many cases I would like to share with you because it's so relevant. And we have always in our population around 100 teenagers, if you go from year 12 to 25, as you said. You know, we are the national clinic, we keep them all under the same roof, so we have a lot of issues to deal with. So I brought a case here. It's a 14-year-old female, and she began to skip breakfast, and her parents hear from school that she avoid eating her lunch and drinking her amino acid supplement in school. Apparently, she wanted to become slim and look good. All of a sudden, she was very focused on her look. And she spends time with her friends after school, but then she goes to McDonald's, which is not very healthy, and reject any advice from the parents. She didn't want to have blood samples taken, and she was not doing well in school, and she seemed tired and unfocused and unconcentrated all the time. So the parents call us, I mean, the mother called us, and she's crying and said, "What can I do?" So do you have a good advice for this?
Well, I think the first thing, you know, just to come back to what I was saying about having a context for understanding this behavior, and that immediately gives us a different set of skills to support this young person. So first of all, you know, remember those tasks of adolescence. We've got to be in our community. So being with your friends and doing what your friends are doing makes you a good community member. Okay, so this young person is absolutely doing what her brain is telling her to do. She's being alongside her friends and doing what her friends are doing. So that immediately takes the heat out of it. It's not a willful, you know, intent to be irritating. It's just, I want to do what my friends are doing. Okay. Mm. So that allows us to take a slightly more, a higher degree of empathy, basically, with this. Remember also about the strength of those emotions. These emotions are strong in adolescence. This is not our imagination. Or the young person's imagination, they're stronger than they have ever been. And so the pull will be much, much stronger. That emotion to be with the friends will be much stronger than any long-standing, well-established medical evidence about how to manage my diet. So that hasn't disappeared, but it's just the volume is turned down on that advice. And I want to be with my friends is the only thing. It's like a siren going off in her brain. Be with your friends, do what your friends are doing. So that is how she's responding, okay? So we need to think about going with those drives rather than fighting against them, because if you fight against them, you're likely to be in an oppositional relationship. There may be situations in which you're having fights. It may be that the food becomes an expression of all sorts of other experiences of anger and so on. You don't want to do that. You want to be on the same side, both of you, against any, you know, any harm occurring, if that makes sense. I also, you know, I bet you that if you ask this young person, she could tell you exactly how to manage her diet. So, you know, it's remembering that reiterating that is unlikely to be helpful, because that's not the problem here. Knowledge base is not the issue. It's about how to allow that knowledge base to stay in her mind when she's in the moment with her friends. Okay, so how could she do that? Do some problem solving and genuinely ask what the issue is. I also notice again that she's not doing well in school. She's tired and she's unconcentrated. Her concentration is not good. I also, again, but of course, you know, because I'm a mental health professional, this is something that is in my mind too. I also want to know a little bit about her mood. Now, if we got to a situation where her diet was well managed and she continued to be tired and unfocused and not engaging in school, I would also want to sort of have a hypothesis that there might be a mental health issue, you know, anxiety, depression, and so on. I'm also interested in the idea of the focus on food, again, because we know that eating disorders are one of the mental health problems that might well emerge in adolescence. So that's another, it's a hypothesis just to hold in mind, to just be aware of that because of the focus on food, which of course is a very, you know, is a very significant one in PKU. So I think it's also about bearing in mind that PKU might be the issue and a rebellion against PKU might be the issue here, but there might also be something else going on. And so as a professional supporting that young person, I would want to hold lots of opportunities or hypotheses in mind at the same time. The key thing here is emphasising and not telling her off or re-saying again how to manage a diet. It's saying, look, it looks like you want to be with your friends. How can we make that happen? How can we allow your diet management to be successful and still have a link with your friends so you're not excluded? I don't know, Bettina, if you've got other things you want to add to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a similar way, I think as an adult, you know, really trying to take a step back, taking the emotional layer out of it. I think Jane and we were talking, weren't we, Jane, about how hard it must be for these parents to let go. I mean, it's hard enough within when you don't have this kind of difficulty to deal with, to allow your kids to kind of go out in the world, you know, the most precious thing in you. It must be absolutely terrifying. And when you hear that, there might be a tendency for us as adults to go in our lower brain, to be a bit explosive. We need to try to take that emotional layer out of our response. If you can't do that in the moment as an adult, take a step back, take a moment, take a little bit of time out yourself, and come back when you're really able to talk about it. Remembering that there is this enormous potential for change and development. Remembering all the things that just Jane was just saying about the context. Don't challenge her when the emotions are high. And just, you know, what we'll come on to talk about a bit more is the importance of collaborative thinking with young people about how are they going to make the change. Telling them what to do, it's not the time. You could tell a 5-year-old what to do, they would listen. A 15-year-old, it needs to be different. We need to approach them in a different way. The other thing I think just to say that Jane and I were talking about when we were thinking about this case earlier was just about the executive functions and particularly working memory. So the research shows us that working memory is likely to be a difficulty for these young people. So we need our working memory and we need our executive function skills to be functioning well in the moment when we're out and about. And that's maybe what might be going on. So we need to think about that with them. But also when their working memory is challenged and when their executive functions are challenged, don't expect to have a good high intensity conversation. It's not going to go well. We know it's not going to go well. Nobody's going to end up solving any problems. So I suppose that's one of the things is just take a step back, try and remember what's going on with them. And then we'll think together, actually, in a future episode about the steps to take, the best way to engage teenagers in a problem-solving conversation.
Well, it has been extremely useful to have you two in the studio today. So thank you very much, Bettina and Jane. I have learned a lot, and I'm sure the audience has as well. We still have a long way to go, but we will do our best. So thank you everyone for listening today, and please join us in our next podcast to continue the discovery of the teenage brain and how to use that knowledge to best support our preteens and teenagers with PKU. So see you next time.
With future episodes of Dan on Nutrition Campus, the Feed podcast, make sure you subscribe on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on. For more updates on the show, or for more educational content from Dan on Nutrition Campus, visit www.danonnutritioncampus.org.